Talk given Saturday, 2nd May 1981. All the great spiritual teachers of the world have affirmed the reality of transcendence. Every single one of them did, including the Buddha, although the Buddha did not choose the usual personalistic, theistic form for affirming that transcendence. His form consisted in the phrase, the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome. And he also declared categorically that were there not the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, there'd be no release from our bondage here to the born, the become, and the made. We live within the sphere of mortality. The unborn, the unbecome, the unmade belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And all the great spiritual teachers, whoever they were, not only the founders of the religions, but every one of them has affirmed the fact of transcendence. Having affirmed the fact of transcendence as the supreme reality, the different teachers gave different forms when they spoke about transcendence, in order that they might reach the people who lived in their time and in that particular culture. Hence we see the differences between the formulations, the verbal formulations, in the great religions of the world. Now, we are under a very great difficulty with regard to understanding all the different affirmations made by the teachers in connection with the fundamental affirmation of transcendence. And this has come about because right from our birth we have been conditioned by our parents, our teachers, our friends, our society, and our culture to have certain beliefs, certain fixed beliefs. These mental fixations condition the mind in a rather unfortunate way. Take, for example, how in all the theistic groups, the belief in a God, a supreme God, sometimes with the addition of other gods, sometimes presented as a trinity, and so forth. How that belief is fixed in the mind of the child long before it can begin to understand what it is all about or what it all means. When the child inquires, "Where did I come from?" or "Who made me?" the answer is, "God made you," you see, and so forth. If the child asks, "Where will I go to when I am dead?" the fundamental assumption there is that there is an I which will go somewhere. And when the question is asked, "Where was I before I was born?" and the answer to that also implies the fundamental assumption that there was an I before I was born. Parents in throughout the world, parents, teachers, friends, and everybody else have been responsible for planting the idea of the I am I in the child as he or she grows up. It takes some time before any child is conscious of itself as I in terms of separateness from you or him or her or the doggy or teddy or whatever it is, you see, or other things in the universe. I am I, separate, different. Now, this fundamental assumption lies at the root of mankind's sorrow and difficulties, confusions, and the mess he makes of his own life. And because a nation is only the collection of all these individuals, the whole nation, the whole of humanity makes its mistakes and suffers the evil consequences thereby. Now this I am I concept, the belief in a God, some remarkable being who is up in the heavens and is possessed of certain characteristics which the parents declare that God has and so forth, conditions our mind very, very strongly. That conditioning sinks deep into the unconscious part of ourselves. Whenever we experience things, whenever we ask questions or make inquiries, we are unaware that that conditioning determines, ineluctably determines, the manner in which our childish brain will interpret what we are experiencing or seeing and so forth. So this is one of the greatest difficulties confronting us who seek to understand and discover what is the truth of things, what is the truth of things. Whenever we approach life with the desire to discover the truth of things, we are hampered by this conditioning, which prevents us from having a truly open mind or truly pure sense activities. All our sense organs deceive us. That is to say, sorry, it's not so much the sense organs which deceive us, but the brain which receives all the impressions via the senses, synthesizes these impressions in the wrong way because of this basic conditioning. It is as if a stream from which people draw their drinking water had some source of poison at the source. It is something like that. And therefore, the understanding, our understanding right from childhood onwards, is largely a misunderstanding. Therefore, it behoves us to do everything possible if we wish to live the truly human life, the pure life, which means the religious life, and which means actually the divine life. If we are sincere and earnest about that, we must decide to keep as open a mind as possible, not to be gullible on the one hand, nor to reject out of hand anything that is presented to us, but to use our senses to look at it, to listen to it, to touch it, taste it, smell it, and so forth, with a completely open mind and be truly observant. It's the brain which is the trouble. The brain is an apparatus, as you know. It's a good computer, but it's a terrible muddler where the understanding of the depths is concerned. One of the main reasons is this. The brain is confined to the realm of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. It belongs to the realm of death. Also, it is concerned with what it has received through the vast evolutionary process for the last 3 or 4 million years at least, as regards the whole of the past. That has determined the activity of our brain as such. The brain, as I have often said, is the concretest manifestation of mind. Mind and consciousness in themselves are immensely vaster than what the brain is and what the brain can do. This we must bear in mind very, very carefully. So, in order to be free of the deleterious effects of this conditioning, which goes deep down into the unconscious and prevents us from seeing truth clearly, we must always challenge whatsoever manner in which we interpret what is conveyed to us by our senses. You know, in India they are very fond of giving this example. A man in the semi-dark, the twilight, sees a rope and he mistakes it for a snake. Now, if he examines that rope carefully, provided he is not afraid that it will be a snake and bite him and kill him, if he examines that rope carefully, he'll see that it is not a snake, it is a rope, you see? And it's the same with us. I'll give you another example, which I believe was an actual experience of some bhikkhus in Thailand. A man used to go down the street, a very nice person he was, a harmless, gentle, quiet person, and somebody used to shout at him, abuse him, and say all sorts of terrible things to him. And of course, he was very upset and annoyed and angry. Till one day, a friend of his said, "Oh, don't worry about that man. Everybody knows he's like that. He's mad." And when this man discovered that that man was a madman, he ceased to react in the manner in which he reacted, with anger and fear and annoyance and all the rest of it. So you see, once one sees something clearly for what it actually is, it ceases to be a source which prevents us from seeing the truth of things. And once one sees the truth of things, one finds peace and harmony and balance, and life becomes very, very different. There is another difficulty. The actual reality of the whole universe, the one total reality as such. We, as we are constituted and as we function here, can interpret only in terms of two contexts. One is the ordinary context of everyday affairs, where the activity of the senses and the brain predominates. And this is the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. The other is the context which some of us have sensed as being the real, as being a real context, as an actual fact, the context of the transcendent, which is infinite, which is eternal and immortal. Now, all our language, all our powers of thinking, of conceiving things, are confined to the realm of the finite and the mortal. And this is the only instrument we have for attempting to express in thought and word and communicating with our fellow human beings things transcendent. And of course we fail miserably, because the finite cannot contain the infinite. It is the infinite which subsumes the finite. It's the other way around. But there is no language, there is no possibility of conceptualizing or verbalizing the infinite. The sphere of the infinite and the immortal is the sphere of silence. Perfect silence. And that perfect silence implies the complete freedom from all the clutter of beliefs, ideas, convictions and so on, which we hold here and now. However near the truth, as we might say, our ideas and knowledge may be, it is only approaching the truth. It never is the whole truth. It never is the complete truth. And it is in this sphere of, which is never the complete truth, that we ordinarily function. This we must appreciate. And if we really appreciate this as the actual actual way in which we function, physically and mentally, then we will see the necessity, the paramount necessity for negating all that our the interpretive activity of our brain tells us. When I say negating, I don't mean that whatsoever the brain tells us is false. That is not the case. Whatsoever the brain tells us with respect to the transcendent has a certain element of truth in it, has a suggestiveness of fact and reality in it, but it is covered over with all our thought coverings, all our concepts and so on about it, which is a layer of falsity. It's as if you had a wonderful wonderful bit of fruit or some lovely thing to eat, which is pure nourishment, but it is all covered over with dust or maybe mud or whatever it is. You have to get rid of that dust and that mud before you can eat that nourishing food. It is something like that. What the brain tells us then is we have to beware of it all the time, because it is conditioned. And it is conditioned not only because of the conditioning which has been put upon us by our circumstance, our surroundings, by our parents and teachers and so on, but we are also most desperately conditioned by our own desires, our passions, our drives, our ambitions, our fears, our jealousies, envies, hatreds, greeds and so on. Our whole psychophysical being, the existential being, the mortal being, is terribly conditioned. If not for this conditioning, if we can be free of all this conditioning, then we would be conscious constantly in terms of the transcendent context, in terms of the infinite and the immortal. Because do remember, the infinite, eternal and immortal completely subsume the finite, temporal and mortal. Now this is a very, very important fact. I don't know, perhaps you can correct me if I am wrong. I have never come across any philosophic system or any statement of this sort in any of the books I've read or talks I have listened to. This clear presentation of the two contexts of the finite, etc., on the one hand, and of the infinite and immortal on the other hand. Now, I talk in terms of two contexts. Actually, because the transcendent context completely subsumes the finite and mortal context, there is only one context, only one total reality. The finite context is the perishable part, is the part which is expressed, pushed out of the transcendent part, so to say. And as such, it is only a plaything, if you like, to put it in the nicest way. It is a plaything of the transcendent context. We are the pawns of the divine. But because we are completely subsumed in this one total reality, in the divine itself, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, as the Buddha put it, for instance. Other teachers have put it in their own way. Because we are completely subsumed in that, there is a relationship between the two. The two are not eternally separate. Otherwise, there's no hope for us. But the possibility and the hope, if you like to use that word, and the expectation lies in the fact, which is an absolute fact, that the infinite, eternal and immortal completely subsumes the finite and the mortal. The people talk of the conquest of death. Now this is a mistaken way of approaching it. There is no such thing as the conquest of death. We are well aware of what we mean by life. And we think, we are deluded in believing that death means a complete annihilation. It means nothing of the sort. Nor does death mean that there is another sort of life in which the particular I am I consciousness as an entity survives. That too is a mistake. When the mortal undergoes what we commonly call death, it is completely taken up into the infinite and the deathless state. Completely taken up into it. And in that infinite immortal state, it is impossible to parcel out bits and say, oh, this was John Brown and that was Mary Smith. It's quite impossible. Then people will say, well, then is there nothing for me? Yes, absolutely nothing for me, as I regard myself in my ignorant state at present. I think that if I do so much good in the world, I deserve a reward in the other place. What an extraordinarily stupid idea. Consider the stupidity of it by considering the growth of the body itself. Here is a child, an infant born. Now, from split second to split second, that child is growing. It's growing, it's growing, it's growing. But what does its growth imply? It means the complete change of the previous state. When a child is born, and when it comes to a little bit of self-consciousness, it starts saying, oh, I'd like to grow 6 feet tall, or I'd like to grow this way or that way, or become so strong, or do this, that and the other. What actually happens to that body? It grows into what it does grow into it, quite irrespective of what the child wished or desired. Completely irrespective of that. But that process of growth implies the release out of the previous condition into the next condition. Now, where the body is concerned, because our eyes and ears and our senses are inside this body itself, we can see this, we can touch this change and growth, and be aware of it in this limited sense. But when the big change takes place, which we commonly call the death of the body, then we can't see the new condition at all. We are unaware of it. As we are, that is. But there is a way by which we can come to know about it. And when we really know about it, it is so extraordinary, so marvelous, that the perfect answer is silence. But it's no good telling you that, because after telling you what I've already told you, I must tell you something else also. There is a continuous development in consciousness. Now, what do I mean by consciousness? I don't mean what people ordinarily mean by consciousness. This is what I say. If you are truly conscious of anything whatsoever, whether it be a quality or an object or a person or anything, you become that quality or thing or person in mind and in consciousness. Now this implies that if you are truly conscious, then that which you are conscious of will manifest itself naturally and spontaneously, without the brain having to think about it and remember something in connection with it or anything. You'll express it naturally and spontaneously in all your thinking, feeling, speaking, and acting. Now this is a mystery. I can't even remember how it suddenly came to me that is how it happens. That is what it means. I can only indicate that there is a hint, just a hint in the Upanishads, and in the Upanishadic teaching in terms of Brahman, which can help one, even at the level of the brain, to thrill in response to this statement, that consciousness, that is what consciousness is, actually. It is said that the absolute all, the absolute reality, use Eckhart's word, Gottheit if you like, or use the ordinary English word God, without all the anthropomorphic limitations imposed by our conditioning upon the word God. You can use that word God. Brahman is absolute being and simultaneously absolute consciousness. Now note carefully, absolute being and absolute consciousness are an identity. They are not separate. The words are separate. And because our brains are conditioned to separate meanings given in the dictionary to the word being and to the word consciousness, we muddle up the whole thing, forgetting that in the context of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, there is no such thing as separateness. There is no such thing as measurement. No such thing as comparison. You might contradict me and say you use the word infinite, which is the which contradicts finitude. It doesn't contradict finitude. It completely subsumes finitude. See, do remember that. Of course, these are also all words, and maybe that I'm muddling you more than ever. But do try and understand this, you see. So you will see, and Brahman, it is out of Brahman that the total cosmos comes into being. God made the universe, as we say, you see. All right. If that is the case, this thing which we call the mind of God or the consciousness of God is a completely, is a totally permeating reality throughout the universe, throughout everything manifested, throughout you and throughout me. We are gods in the making. That is to say, not so much in the making as in the process of our awakening. We awaken to our godhood. And that is really the purpose of human existence, that the Supreme comes to self-realization of itself, its own transcendence, through you, through me, through you, through you, through each and every one. And it comes to self-realization only in terms of the actual manifestation. Through a saint, God comes to self-realization as human sainthood. Through an evil man, We won't name anybody at the moment. There are plenty of examples living in the world. God comes to self-realization as evil. Now, that's a terrible thing to say. Because, you see, we are conditioned to believe that God is the all good. But how do we define good? We define good only as the opposite of bad. And our dualistic good-bad is only a petty little aspect of the total universal process and existence. You see? If everything emerged out of the one total reality, the one total supreme, whatever that supreme is, call it primordial creative energy if you like, if everything has emerged out of that, everything is contained within that. Nothing is thrown out. God doesn't say, oh, you're a bad chap, get out of my universe. Well, where are you going to get out? There is no other place to get to. You see? So, we have to grow in awareness, in consciousness, in such a manner that we are able to be as completely inclusive as the divine is inclusive with respect to his entire universe. Now, if he can become inclusive like that, all our ordinary conflict between acceptance and rejection, wanting to accept what we call good and happy and pleasant to us, and to reject what we call bad and evil and unpleasant to us. The conflict between those two opposites disappears altogether. You neither accept nor do you reject. You just are completely aware that that is how it is. And it is this extraordinary, all-inclusive, transcendent awareness which enables you to be the source of transcendent energy flowing into you and out of you and effecting the purification of what we in our relativistic universe call the bad, the evil. It transforms that and brings it into the realm of the good. You know, the converted devil is he becomes such a saint that he's hard to equal in his sanctity. Take the case, if you like, of Mary Magdalene. She came to see Jesus. Well, you know what she came to see Jesus about. When she met him, she was converted into a saint. Oh. This consciousness of the Son of God, as we call Jesus, this consciousness had that potency within it which transformed all the ill-expressed, the sick psychical energy in Mary Magdalene and effected the miracle, as we call it. But you know very well, or perhaps you don't, because you may not have ever experienced it, but a person A, in the presence of B, is unable to think evil thoughts or have evil feelings or anything like that, or to use bad language and so forth. Why? The influence of the consciousness of B is such, because it is at such a profound level, such a pure level, that A finds it impossible in the presence of B to be evil. And when that sort of thing is experienced by A, A undergoes a transformation, a purification. A complete purification, as in the case of Mary Magdalene. But then that was the influence of such a remarkable being as Jesus. Take the case, if you like, of Angulimala, the murderous robber in India, who, when he saw the Buddha coming along in the woodland, thought, ah, now I'm going to get him and I'll kill him and rob him of whatever he has. Although all that he had was a begging bowl and his robes. But the Buddha filled his own mind with such a power of friendliness, of compassion, of perfect equanimity, metta, karuna, upekha, and so forth, you see, filled his mind with such a power that Angulimala found himself unable to move up to the Buddha and seize hold of him. He couldn't move. And after a while, they had a conversation, and Angulimala was very surprised at what had happened and this, that and the other, and wanted an explanation. And so the Buddha started giving him an explanation. And the final result of the whole story is that Angulimala became one of his disciples and, if you please, attained arhatship, the supreme liberation. Now, what do you think of that? Now, this is consciousness at work. Consciousness is something we don't know. It is an invisible, it is hidden from perception through the use of our senses or the use of our brain. But it is according to what your inner consciousness actually is, will be your states of mind, your emotions, your thoughts, your actions and your words and so on, will be the expression. All these are the expressions of this mysterious thing which certainly the Upanishadic teachings have called consciousness, which the Buddha called mind. So this transformation of consciousness takes place. Now, what is one of the key points in this transformation of consciousness? The key point is just this. In every one of us is the divine potential. And if we are fortunate enough, I don't mean fortunate in the sense of some external fate being kindly towards us, but if we are fortunate enough somehow to have this sense of the transcendent awaken in the slightest possible measure in our life, then that sense of transcendence can grow and grow and grow. And that affects our consciousness in such a manner that we are able to see the truth as our senses, our sense organs, which undergo purification, and our brain, which is the instrument for logical conceiving and verbalizing, whatever comes to us through that. So that way it grows and grows. So now we may make another inquiry. What value are the scriptures? Look at one of the very great conditionings upon us. The followers of the different faiths say that their teachers taught them the truth which they received directly from God or Brahman or the Supreme Being or Ramazda or Allah or whatever it is, you see. That they received it directly. And of course, what does a little child think when he is told that Jesus learned from God directly? He thinks of God as a super Jesus or a kind of a superman. That's all. We immediately think in terms of our own likeness. Genesis tells us that Elohim created man in his own living likeness. Instead of that, what all of us do is to project God out of our befuddled brains in our likeness. For the IRA, I suppose, God must be a super IRA leader or commander. We are as stupid as that. And let us make no mistake about it. We are stupid. We are super kind to ourselves in calling the human race Homo sapiens. Sapiens? Stultus would be true. Sapiens? No. This sapiens, this capacity to savvy, really to know the whole truth, is something which belongs to the perfected holy ones. When the psyche is completely purified of all its dualistic struggles and so on, it becomes empty, totally empty of all concepts, beliefs, convictions, ideas. Whenever ideas crop up, and they will of course continue to crop up, the person who is wise just looks at it, examines it, and lets it pass by. Something new will take its place. And if he knows how to receive the new, that new will always be a stage further, a stage more advanced than the previous stage. So now, who wrote the scriptures? Not divine beings, not deities, not superhuman beings in the wrong sense of the word superhuman. You see, not them. Men, and in some cases women. Some of the hymns of the Rig Veda, for instance, have been written by women, and they are wonderful hymns too. You see, perfected holy ones, women were, just as much as men were. That is, but not just as many, apparently. Any women's lib people here? Forgive me. So, it is people like you and I who, having gone through the baptism of water and the baptism of fire, and have come out perfected as the true humans, it is we who wrote the scriptures. And as the centuries pass by, it is you and I who will keep on writing new scriptures. Therefore, all my heresies of today will perhaps be the accepted things of tomorrow. Or perhaps not so early. Let us say the next century. It's a little bit like that. So we must examine with a completely open mind as far as we are capable of doing it. I say as far as we are capable, because the great hindrance is here. The brain will interpret according to its own conditioning without my being conscious of it. I do not know that the brain is doing the dirty on me. You see? That is why when I read a certain profound scriptural text, I might say, oh, that means this, that and the other. But have I taken into account my own conditioning, which has played its part in making me say these words and produce these ideas? So you see what our task is like, as far as the living of the religious life is concerned, and as far as accepting the validity of all the scriptural statements. Now, I do not mean by this that we should just cast aside the scriptures. Not at all. Far from it. A lame man has to use a stick or crutches. And we are all lame, and we are all blind up to a point, and we are all deaf and dumb and stupid. So we must use what is absolutely necessary for us. But being on the lookout all the time for what the crutches are like and how they function. And as we look out like that and see the crutches as crutches, we find ourselves becoming independent of the crutches. We don't need them anymore. To put it in the nice way, a healthy little child, infant, as it grows up, it will soon walk on its own feet, then it will run and dance and jump and do all the things that it can do. Now, there is a wonderful expression of the real meaning of consciousness. When the child runs, he is so completely conscious of running. What running is, that his brain doesn't know it. His body just runs, doesn't it? Now, do you get that? You get that fact? Take the newborn infant. The newborn infant is so completely conscious of suckling its mother's breast that it just does it. And that is the profoundest level of consciousness. It is so profound that that the discriminative consciousness and the total unconscious are completely at one. It's the unified mind at work, functioning freely, without let or hindrance. This is the meaning of consciousness. And it is in this way that we have to grow into the consciousness of our own divinity. If you try to grow into the consciousness of a divinity